M laid down his pipe and stared at it tetchily. We have no choice. We're just going to bring forward this other chap you've been preparing. You didn't tell me his name. It's Bond, sir, the Chief of Staff replied. James Bond.
So, Anthony, this is your first visit to Bletchley Park.
I'm surprised and a little embarrassed to admit it. I don't quite know why I haven't been here before, and in fact, maybe I have been here, but so long ago that I've forgotten, because one of the funny things about Bletchley Park is that it's so iconic that the moment I see that house, I know it. In fact, the moment I walk into these grounds, I feel that it's part of my life. And yet I can't remember if, physically, I have actually come here, and I think I haven't. I'm surprised because, of course, writing Foyle's War, as I did for 16 years, it was so much part of that story. Although, at the same time, we never set an episode here. We never actually wrote about anybody working at Bletchley Park. There is a reason for that.
What was the reason for that?
We got axed.
Well, yes.
I had a story, which I was going to write, set at Bletchley Park, all about code-breaking. And it was all set up for the season, which never happened,
yeah.
Because ITV decided to pull the plug on us. So we missed 1944 and jumped straight to 1945, or maybe from 1943, yes, that's right, to 1945, and missed out a whole year, and then just had to write about the end of the war. And then, of course, we were brought back again, but by then it was too late.
Is that why you made Adam Wainwright an ex-code breaker at Bletchley Park?
Yes, that's the only connection that I had left, was to have somebody who had actually worked there. So it was part of that story. He had originally been a character in the story that never appeared.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Have we got a world exclusive there?
Well, sort of. You have a little bit of trivia, a little bit of TV trivia. The name, anyway. The name was there before where he came from.
Well, we are big fans of Foyle's War.
Well, it's nice to hear it. Thank you.
Now, this is your second Bond novel.
It is.
With the first one, you set it a few weeks after what happens in Goldfinger,
That's
didn't
correct,
it?
Yes.
Was that your choice to set it then?
Yes, it seemed to me, and Sebastian Faulks, Jeffrey Deaver and William Boyd had done fantastic books of their own, and I'm not having any disagreement with what they did, but it seemed to me that for my books, it should be set, Trigger Mortis that is, absolutely within the Bond canon, and that it should somehow fit into the timeline. And looking at it, there is a gap of a few months after Goldfinger. So I thought, why not actually see what happens to Bond once he gets home from that mission, or having just strangled Goldfinger in the Stratosphere cruiser, and comes home with Pussy Galore. And it was fantastic when the estate said that she could appear as a character in the book as well. She's in the early chapters. And so that is when the story is set. Then when they invited me back a second time to write Forever and a Day, I looked again at the canon. I thought to myself, well, we don't really know what happened to Bond just before Casino Royale. There is a very oblique reference. There's one chapter in Casino Royale where he talks about having done two kills in order to earn an 007 number. And that seemed like an interesting place to begin a story and to examine what it is that makes Bond into the sort of hard-edged, cold-blooded assassin that we know from the books. So that's what my book explores.
Now, you've gone for a very strong female lead in this book, haven't
Madame
you?
Madame 16, yes.
And is she Bond's mentor?
There isn't an element of that in her. She's an older woman, which I think is interesting. She's 10 years senior to James Bond himself, and that's part of her attraction, incidentally, to him. She is very much more experienced than he is. She's also, incidentally, a spy. She has worked herself at Bletchley Park during the war, which is an interesting connection with today. Yes, she was a cipher clerk here. Then she joined the SOE, and then she went into occupied France. Bad things happened to her, and she ended up after the war as a sort of a secret agent working for herself. And she is pretty tough, and certainly she's Bond's equal in every sense, and in some ways, his superior. And I have to say, I began writing the book before the Me Too explosion happened. But anyway, there was no way that I would have written in the 21st century a James Bond book with a submissive and sort of, you know, sexually available young woman. It's just not in keeping with our times. But as things have happened and as the Me Too movement has taken off, and I applaud it, of course, I am very glad that she, Madame 16, is such a strong character.
In the books, the female leads are quite strong women, aren't they, in most of the books? Whereas in the films, you know, they are just made lesser characters, aren't they?
I think that's true of some of the films, not all of them. It is true, certainly, of all the characters in the James Bond novels, where they are certainly women who hold their own. I mean, Plenty O'Toole is a wonderful gangster, as is Pussy Galore. Gala Brand is an undercover policewoman. So, you know, they're not simpering and waiting for Bond to come into their life. At the same time, there are one or two girls who do seem to have little role outside, you know, going to bed with Bond in one chapter. The films have had their fair share of strong women too. I think it's Monica Bellucci in Skyfall, or in Inspector, for example, who is a brilliantly drawn character. So Perhaps in the Roger Moore era, you might say that's the case. But then, you know, 70s and 80s, our attitudes were different.
When you come to writing one of these Bond novels, do you have to get into the mindset of trying to write as Ian Fleming? Because he's so well known for his descriptions, isn't he? You know, whether it's the gun or a car or a meal, it's so descriptive, well, isn't it?
Fleming is a brilliant writer. Mm. I mean, first of all, he absolutely encapsulates perfectly a certain era, that sort of Cold War, post-war Britain. He has also created the first modern spy, just as Doyle created the first modern detective. Even Le Carré has admitted that his work was, in a sense, a reaction to or against Ian Fleming. As a stylist, he is also an extraordinarily good writer. Nobody writes action like Ian Fleming. His action sequences are first rate. The set pieces, which aren't always incidentally action, are also brilliantly observed. Think about the bridge game in Moonraker or Bond playing golf with Goldfinger.
Do you have one of those set pieces or, you know, the Baccarat game?
No, when you read Forever and a Day, you'll see that there are at least two major set pieces. There's, first of all, there is a card game in a casino early in the book. There is the first confrontation with the main gangster, which takes place in a chemical factory, which I think is probably the most violent chapter ever written in a James Bond novel. And then there's a final sort of, you know, explosive finale on board a cruise ship where there's a ton of action happening. So I was going to say, you know, there are different pieces to Fleming's writing, each one of which has to be absorbed into my own book, starting with the action, the set pieces, but then also the sort of the business of the book, the plotting and the sort of the characterization. And thirdly, I suppose, there is the poetry of the books, what Fleming himself or Bond called acidie, this view of the world, which is sort of slightly jaded, slightly tired, slightly cynical, but at the same time deeply sort of felt. So it doesn't feel hard-edged. It feels quite mournful and sad, and that's in there too.
And have you enjoyed writing them? Have you enjoyed being in that world?
I enjoy all my writing. I wouldn't write if I didn't enjoy it. It's my love of writing and my passion for words and for stories and for character that propels me. But there is a particular pleasure to be had in writing a James Bond novel because I realise that I am, first of all, following in the footsteps of a writer who is much better than me, Ian Fleming, and secondly, because having loved the books as a child, there is no better way to immerse myself in them than to write them and to have in my hands James Bond. I mean, it's an extraordinary feeling.
Quite a lot of your writing has been on the secret side of the world.
Yes, I think it's true. I mean, I write a lot about detectives. I've also written a lot about spies, Alex Rider for young people, of course. And I suppose secrets have always been of interest to me. The way I see the world is this, is that every person you meet, every building you look at, every place you go, there's what you see in front of your eyes and there's what you don't know. It's what, and what's being kept
what's
from you, what's being hidden.
Yes.
It's where does that door go to? Where's the secret passage? My first great love when I was a kid was the Tintin books. And the Tintin books were absolutely full of secret passages. So that Tintin might go past a tree and the tree would open and there'd be a spiral staircase hidden in the trunk going downstairs underground to the secret society headquarters. And that's what I've always grown up with. But I think in a funny way, that's what writing is about. It's about probing behind what is shown to you superficially.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony, for your time, and thank you for giving us a little hint of we could have been on Foyle's War, but
next time
we never got to make it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.